Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe.
I'm Taylor Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mackie.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Foodish.
Yes, indeed, you're listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And as usual, we've got plenty to talk about. We've only got one guest on this show because I think listeners will find it extremely interesting. It is a man that was involved in the London 2012 Olympic bid and who was also a former Olympic athlete, or rather was an Olympic athlete. I know we're not meant to use the former, are we? So I've got to correct that. But anyway, John, plenty happening in your sport. I don't know if you've seen how Hockey India have changed the rules of the game for the Hockey India League, which would take place in February next year. It's going to be two goals, or rather a field goal is worth two. Is it 2 points, two goals? That actually isn't determined. And then a penalty stroke if it is a clear foul by a player inside the circle, that also will be worth two. However, from a penalty corner, if the goalkeeper's beaten and the defender is behind and he accidentally or inadvertently stops the ball going in, a penalty stroke in that situation will only be worth one. And if it goes to a shootout, a penalty stroke will only be worth one. All I can say is, as a commentator, thanks very much, Hockey India, explaining that to viewers.
I just don't understand why. I can understand that they are worried about the preponderance of goals scored from a short corner. And so they're looking at ways where they might encourage more goals from open play. But doesn't that just confuse everything and create another level of interpretation where umpires are going to have to side one way or the other, where depending on which side of the fence you sit on, you could call the same incident either way?
Well, the one thing I'd say, John, and I keep a record in all the tournaments that I do on who scores field goals, who scores penalty corners, who scores penalty strokes, and I can tell you in the three major tournaments that I've done this year, field goals are well ahead of penalty corner goals. So you're getting more field goals than you get penalty corner goals anyway. I don't think you really need to, and I think when you consider that the IOC was saying that hockey had to make the game more appealing to a viewer, is this going to make it more appealing? I think there are other rules that maybe should have been tinkered with to make it, you know, a little bit easier to understand than suddenly making a field goal worth 2 points.
See, as I understand it, if a player deliberately gives away a free hit inside the circle, it's a penalty stroke. And the player gets a card. So why are you making it two goals all of a sudden? That's three times you're being punished for the one infringement.
Yep.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. A goal's a goal. The ball goes in the back of the net, it's worth one. That's it. Easy.
I would have thought so. I didn't think you'd like it, but I just thought I'd make you aware of the changes.
The worst thing is those rules end up filtering down to grades that aren't being umpired by people who are paid to do it at a professional level. And that's when it starts to turn real messy and no one really understands what's going on.
Absolutely. Now, the Rugby World Cup, as we're recording this, is about to get underway. And I was very interested to read how it's called World Rugby now, not the IRB, have realised that interest is the highest it's ever been, and that's seen a rise in profile of the game, and they're acknowledging the fact that it's going to attract record levels of betting compared to previous tournaments. Now, what they've done is, because they realise the threats to the integrity of the sport and also other sports have experienced, they've basically sat down to come up with implementing the best way of committing or facing this head on, and they've spoken to the International Olympic Committee and they've put in place what they say is a robust and proportionate integrity program for the Rugby World Cup 2015. Its stated purpose is to protect the tournament and its participants from corrupt practices and unauthorized gambling. Now, in addition to that, the World Rugby has partnered with the UK Gambling Commission along with the UK Police to establish a sophisticated integrity framework around the event. And also central to that, all of the players, there's going to be an education program for all of the players, all of the teams, and all of the match officials who are participating in the World Cup, that they have to sit through that before the tournament gets underway.
Oh, it's a lot for them to take in, isn't it? When you consider they just want to go out there and smash each other.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, and we've said on the show, the one way to stop that is just limit what you can bet on. Instead of having all these other bets that you can have first try, just say you can only bet on the result. End of.
That would fix the problem instantaneously. Although not the black market economy, you'd still have that going. But cricket got sucked in by that anyway.
Yeah, you're always going to have that.
I did want to ask you about the name change there, the IRB to, what is it, World Rugby.
Yeah.
How much do you reckon they paid the marketing boffins to come up with that piece of genius?
I'm not sure, but if you remember, we were announced it about a month before it was announced officially.
Just quietly, when you get home, pull up Google on your computer, type in IRB, just those three letters, and see what comes up. Then scrub that search and type in WOR and see what comes up. And I think that's a terrible, terrible mistake that a lot of sports make. We've talked about Waha doing the same thing. IRB was perfect for this, the initial generation.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it was ridiculous. Now, the other thing, and I wrote a piece on the website, notthefootyshow.com, is I was interested to read how rugby league in the UK is really struggling, apparently. Viewer figures have gone down by 15%, and they were saying that now they're seeing less and less players cross over from rugby union to rugby league, but there are more coming the other way from rugby league to rugby union. And I just really wonder, and it was saying that the Rugby World Cup could really decimate the English Rugby League this year, because obviously their season is running at the same time as the World Cup is going, and all the attention is going to be on union. And I just wonder where that's going to leave the game. And we talked about in a previous show the money that Australia's got, and I wonder whether Australia's going to almost have to do an IPL or an HIL to really reinvigorate the game over here.
Well, it's no surprise that when you lose the poster boy for your sport and your country to another code, that you're going to lose some traction. And I'm talking about Sam Burgess. I mean, he was the poster boy for English
Absolutely.
Rugby League.
Absolutely. No denying.
The other side of it is how important Jarryd Hayne is now to rugby league and the NRL especially, because he provides them as a gateway into the US that they've been searching for a long time. Just the fact that he's an ex-rugby player is enough. That he doesn't have to do anything more than that except play a few games for whoever, San Francisco. And that gives them such a huge in. Now, if they can make inroads there, that could secure their future. But if they don't...
Doesn't it also mean, though, that rugby league now faces another threat, in that Jarryd Hayne's success is going to see American football scouts coming over here and looking for similar players to Jarryd Hayne, offering them far more money than they're going to be able to get in the NRL. And we're going to see, not only are they going to lose players to rugby union, they're now threatened with losing players to NFL.
Well, it depends a lot how this whole experiment goes. I mean, if Hayne fails from here, say he gets cut after five games, you know, are those scouts going to still come out here? Oh, gee, if Jarryd Hayne can't make it, you know, what chance have some of these other guys got? And on the reverse side of that is, we can't lose sight of how exceptional this is. It is not just a matter of any old rugby player is going to wander over to America and play gridiron at that level. They're going to have to be an exceptional player.
No, couldn't agree with you more. Now, just talking about exceptional players, just want to send out a congratulations, because the Australian Sevens boys and girls teams recently did really well representing the country at the 2015 Commonwealth Youth Games in Samoa, where they earned gold and silver. So the girls team were in scintillating form, and they won the title 14 months ago and disposed of Canada 36-5, while the boys lost to South Africa 31-20 in their gold medal match. But now with sevens as an Olympic sport, these sort of tournaments are going to be crucial, and it's great to see that there is young talent coming up that may see Australia in the men's and the women's game. Not for these Olympics, but the ones after Rio, we may still have a good crop of players coming through.
And I'm hoping to see the Australian Rugby Board get behind them once the World Cup's over. I mean, it's been very much in the background so far, but once this World Cup is done and dusted, I'm really hoping that they'll try and give it some profile, more profile, because it will be their face at the Olympics.
Yeah, now they really, I agree, have to ramp up those sevens players and the interest in the game and try and get as much televised as possible.
I'm Azuma Nelson, and you are listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, shall we move on to our lonely guest for this show?
We shall.
Now, I was very fortunate to sit and have a very nice glass of Malbec with our next guest when I was in Argentina commentating on the Hockey World League semi-finals. David Luckers was a former international hockey player with England and Great Britain. He went to the Olympic Games, and it was while he was playing at the Olympic Games and at that elite level that he was approached to be a part of doing the feasibility study for London's bid for the 2012 Olympics. Now, I think you'll find, whether you love the Olympic Games in London or not, just how the whole process worked and some of the challenges he faced, and also his working conditions early on, really interesting. I know I did, and that's why I wanted our next guest to share his memories with you. David Luckers, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks, Ashley.
Well, before we talk about your involvement with the Olympic bid for London, I wanted to just touch on your international hockey career, because you did attend three Olympic Games with Great Britain. Are they some of your happiest memories?
Yeah, certainly a very special time to go to one Olympics is obviously the highlight of any sportsman's career, but to have the ability to go to three is special as well. I mean, are they the highlight? I don't know. I mean, it's I wish I'd played a little bit more when I actually went to them. I spend a bit of time on the bench as much as playing. So I hold a little bit mixed memories. We didn't do ourselves justice in certainly the 92 Olympics, I think, where we came unstuck against the Australians in the last match. But yeah, I mean, it's a special experience for anyone, and to have that opportunity, say to go to three is something very special.
You mentioned Australia, and I did hear that you never actually won a game against Australia. Is that true?
That is true. It's not even the case of whether I was playing or whether I was team part of the squad. I think I remember sitting with actually the now coach of England, Bobby Crutchley. We were sharing a room, and I actually worked out that, and this was the Commonwealth Games, I think, in 1998 in Kuala Lumpur. I actually worked out that I'd been involved in 33 matches at that point against Australia, and we hadn't won one. And then we went on to play the Australians in the semi-final, and unfortunately we came unstuck on the golden goal in extra time. So no, it didn't get any better from there.
Well, you were very much involved in London's bid for the Olympic Games in 2012. How did that all come about?
It was probably a little bit ad hoc to start with. I was still playing hockey, so this was back in the start of 1997, and I was also a member of the Athletes Commission of the British Olympic Association. And I took a call from the chairman of the BOA, Craig Reedy, who's now Sir Craig Reedy and heading WADA. And he said, well, do you want to come along and just do the feasibility work looking at the 2004 bidding cities? And he said, won't pay anything. He said, you might get some expenses, but just come along and do it and see where it goes. So I didn't actually have anything else going on because I was still playing at that point. So I said, yep, okay, I'll do it, and did a 3-month initial feasibility that then turned into, they added another 3 months onto it and took me through. They started paying me a very small wage at that point just to keep me going. From that, it was agreed that, you know, we'd start commissioning a little bit more work. But again, even back in 1997, so almost 20 years ago now, I mean, it started from very small roots, you know, to the point where I didn't even have an office. I had a desk in a in a corridor at the British Olympic Association in those days. And so everything was done very much hand to mouth, and there was no particular budget for it. But, you know, we kept things ticking over. We did what we could do at a very low level. And actually, we made quite a bit of progress with the various local authorities and local government in London to try and move it along. It is worth noting that, you know, back when I started there, it was almost impossible to run a London Olympic Games because there wasn't a Mayor of London at that point. So the mayor only came on in 2000. So back in the late 90s, you were having to deal with 33 individual London boroughs, which made it nigh impossible to do anything. But thankfully then, you know, the whole sort of governance structure of London changed, and a mayor came on board with a budget and also responsibility for funding and running certain projects like this, and therefore the mood changed and the opportunity changed as well.
It just seems incredible that such a crucial job, you were in the corridor working at a desk, and I presume people bustling past you on a daily basis.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there probably was a view back then that this was a little bit of a flight of fancy. I don't think anyone gave too much credibility for all the reasons I just mentioned about the, you know, the whole structure. And also on the back of three failed Olympic bids, two with Manchester and one with Birmingham, that came up woefully short in terms of being able to really put a credible Olympic bid in front of the International Olympic Committee. And that was because in the end, you know, you have to bid with your prize jewels. And for us, that was London. And London was the only place that the world of sport was interested in coming and visiting. But at that time, it just didn't have the structure to be able to host an event of that nature. So everything was kind of not really aligned for us to even consider mounting a bid until the Mayor of London became a physical entity, and other projects such as the Millennium Dome and the XL Exhibition Centre, those then started giving a new impetus to the infrastructure developments in East London. And that really started crystallising, you know, our opinion that something was actually viable in London, something could actually happen that was special. But up to that point, it was quite tough.
So obviously that was when the whole bid process gained momentum. How difficult was it to get sort of all the politicians on board?
It was difficult, I think, probably quite difficult to get central. So the central administration, the UK government bought into it because, you know, they'd also gone through the whole process of three failed Olympic bids and Lord knows how many failed World Cup football bids. And so they were a little bit tarnished by what they saw was, you know, was it a level playing field that you were operating in? What were the rules in terms of bidding? And so I think that they probably looked at it a little bit cynically at that point. I think when the Mayor of London came in, and myself and then the chief executive of the BOA, Simon Clegg, we went and presented to the Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, and he actually stopped the presentation after 5 minutes and said, look, I'm not interested in sport. I don't know much about sport. I play a bit of billiards. But apart from that, you know, sport doesn't interest me, apart from what it can do for my constituents. So, you know, he was very clear. He saw that as a regeneration project, and that could unlock both central government funds and also European Union funds. And that was a great opportunity to rebuild part of his capital city, or as he saw it, his capital city. But the one thing he did say, because at that point we still had two options on the table. We had a West London Olympic bid option. We had an East London Olympic bid option. And because Wembley was under reconstruction at that point, and it was supposedly being reconstructed as a national stadium for football, rugby league and athletics. And that didn't actually come to pass. But at that point, you know, we didn't know that. But what he did say, he said, look, you know, I'm totally on board with this so long as it's in East London. So you do it in East London and you have my backing. And therefore that, from our point of view, we were like, okay, fine. You know, if that's what it takes, that's a decision taken. It'll be East London. And we had good options in terms of, or certainly, you know, pretty viable options in terms of Olympic Village locations, which probably the major land area, and also Olympic Park options at near Stratford, Hackney Wick, and that area. So I think getting the support of the mayor was relatively straightforward at that point. It was in going and talking to central government, who ultimately would be the guarantors of the finances, which was always going to be a little bit tougher.
One of the stories you told me that I do like is the printers made a mistake when they were printing one of the documents, so it looked a lot bigger, which actually probably stopped a lot of the politicians reading it. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I just hypothesise on that, but I do think actually it became sort of quite symbolic. I mean, at the British Olympic Association, you know, I wrote this 395 page. Document, so this feasibility study that we then took around to the presentations with the mayor and the central government, and basically anyone else that would give us the time of day. And my total budget for this project was £400, which was for printing, and I took it next door to the printers Prontoprint in Wandsworth Centre. And they should have done it double-sided. They actually did do a couple of copies double-sided, but then they messed up and for some reason did all the rest single-sided. So a document that was still quite thick actually became fairly massive and was, you know, it's like an edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So in the end, we took that with us because it actually looked really impressive. Hopefully what was in it was quite impressive as well, but I'm not necessarily sure that everyone sat down to read 395 pages of feasibility of a London Olympic bid. But, you know, in terms of a presentational tool, it was something a little bit more dramatic that came about very much by chance, and the fact that the printers got it wrong.
Were there any things that you sort of uncovered that were quite interesting when you were doing the feasibility study? Because I know when we were talking, you sort of debunked the myth that the football is one of the most profitable parts of the Olympic Games.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the whole football angle of the Olympic Games is almost a conversation itself, because it's a mechanism. It's the only sport, it was up until now, the only sport that you could take around the country. And so therefore, politically, it became a very important tool. And initially, we were looking to then host events in Scotland, in Northern Ireland and Wales, as well as, you know, other regions of England. Northern Ireland didn't come off just because Windsor Park at that time, and probably even now, I think they're rebuilding it now, wasn't up to FIFA standards. But football, for example, gives you the political ammunition to take the Olympic Games to other parts and other regions. But yeah, I mean, it's in terms of your percentage of tickets sold in football, it's probably the lowest out of every single sport. I think it was coming in at just over 70%, which is, you know, still impressive when you think about the capacities of the football stadium. But when you look at archery, I think archery sold something like 98-99% of tickets. So it's you end up sort of seeing things in a very different light. And just even working with 26 sports that we had, we initially started off with 28 sports, and then baseball and softball were dropped. You do see many, many different sides to how sport is run, how sport is governed, how sport is constituted. I mean, even going back to a sport that we didn't end up doing, which was baseball, we had many meetings with Paul Sheldon, who was chief executive of Surrey County Cricket Club, about staging baseball at the Oval. Lords didn't want to touch it. We managed to persuade Lords to do archery, and I think even until 6 months out, they assumed that archery would just involve us turning up the day before with a couple of targets setting up and going off. And in the end, you know, we had to completely dig up the whole of the surface of Lords, which is no mean feat to get that agreed. And it was, well, I think we finished the archery competition 12 days before there was a test match against South Africa, and that had to be relayed in those 12 days. So, I mean, those are all tricky things. And the reason that the baseball fell over at the Oval, why we didn't propose that, was that the major sticking point came to when I think second base would have ended up right on the length of the test wicket, and which meant digging up the whole of the square. And I think at that point, then suddenly there was a dawning of realization from the guys at Surrey what actually putting this on meant. But we had a lot of conversations along those lines. You know, whether it be the staging of equestrian at a World Heritage site at Greenwich Park, or putting the beach volleyball event at Horse Guards Parade just after Trooping the Colour celebrations had finished there, and putting up a 15,000 seat stadium in 5 weeks before the Olympic Games. I mean, so much stuff to do, and so many people, as you can probably imagine, that you have to get on site to do these things. So very, very interesting.
Having sort of helped put the bid together, did you actually enjoy the games when they were on, or were all these little projects that you had to make sure went according to plan, did that sort of give you a pretty stressful games?
No, the games itself was relatively stress-free, and I say that on the basis that probably 3 years leading up to it was quite stressful, but because we did an extensive program of testing, we had, you know, very good members in the team, whether it be in the sport team, but also across all the other different functional areas. You know, so some really quality people. In the end, once government decided to do it, they were very keen that we did it properly. And so therefore, you know, even the financial side of it, yep, there was budget cuts, and there were times when you had to really go cap in hand to try and get something agreed. But in the end, I'd say that compared to probably most other games, we did most of the planning, or we did all the planning up front. We did all the testing up front. We did scenario planning, scenario testing. So we went through all the different permutations of things that could possibly happen and our possible responses to it. So that when games time come, actually, we felt pretty well prepared. And, you know, there's always going to be certain elements of whether it be the weather or security or things that are actually just outside of the scope of what you can reasonably expect or deal with. In the end, we did everything that we could. So at games time, it ran pretty smoothly. And, you know, the amount of issues we had to deal with that were what you would call big issues, probably on the fingers of one hand.
How do you go back to a normal life having invested so many years? Like you said, you started on this in 97, and then obviously it goes through to 2012. That's a long time to be focused on one event.
Yeah, it is. And albeit, I suppose the question is, going back to a normal life, I'm not actually sure I came from a normal life, because at that point, you know, I'd been through university, done postgrads, just as a means, I'd been signing on the dole as a means of being able to play international hockey, because there wasn't lottery support, there wasn't the funding that came through into the sport until probably the late 90s, just as I was finishing. So I'd done a number of weird and wonderful things to keep myself ticking over in the 90s. So it wasn't the case of having to go back to reality. It was trying to find out what reality actually looked like. And when I finished with the Paralympics, then I was fortunate enough to get offered the role which I currently have, which is Director of Sport and Development at the International Hockey Federation. So I still keep very much in touch with a lot of the people who I used to work with, or who were stakeholders of mine, so the other international federations. And I'm still very much part of that world, and I'm still doing lots of stuff on Rio, and then looking forward to Tokyo as well. So I haven't dropped totally off the face of the earth when it comes to that Olympic engagement. It's just I sit on a different side of the fence now.
Is Rio going to be ready on time?
Rio will be ready. I think that there's always, you know, a question mark in terms of until you get through the test events, quite how it will look. And, you know, to what degree there are issues on the ground that maybe you don't see on televised broadcasts. I think that, generally speaking, Rio has some very good people working in it. It's got some challenges in terms of really unlocking the budgets. I think since Rio won the games, then there's been a big economic downturn in Brazil. So I think that's actually caused them quite a bit of hardship in terms of reviewing how best they use they use their money. We've been very open, certainly within hockey, of working with them to try and find creative solutions to all of this, because we know, you know, certainly having come from my background as well, I sort of understand the place that they're in. They're responsible for funding certain elements of venue construction, but also they have the mayor and the federal government that are responsible for other sections of that. So there's always a justification. I think they'll come through. I think there's probably going to be some tough times ahead. But I think with the will of all parties to make this successful, I think it will. I think that it has to be judged against its own criteria. It's difficult to judge it against London, as it was to judge London against Beijing, because they're very just different cities, different cultural and political climates and contexts. And, you know, we have to take Rio for what it is. And I think it will be a fantastic Games, but it will just have a different feel to it.
David, fantastic to catch up with you once again, and thanks so much for your time and obviously sharing your part in putting on London 2012.
Pleasure, Ashley.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, that was David Luckers, and I hope you found his memories of the whole London Games being put together really interesting. I know I did, and interesting that he talks very positively about Rio and says, John, how we shouldn't, and I'll be honest, I fall into that trap, where we shouldn't judge each Games by comparison, in that obviously every city is very, very different. For example, Beijing, very different culturally, geographically, climate, everything to Beijing, and Rio's going to be different to London. And so we do all tend to compare by what we've just had, but maybe we're being a little bit unfair by doing that.
I think we definitely are. If I was selected for an Olympic Games, I wouldn't care which city it was in. It wouldn't worry me one bit, and I don't think it worries any of the athletes either.
No, but it is interesting, because, as I say, I will admit that I've fallen into that trap. And it's great to see, though, that Rio is using experienced people like David to try and get their games to be the best they can be.
I've still not heard someone who's been in an Olympic Games absolutely bag it. I've heard them say, oh, there was an issue with this or something else. But I've never heard someone say it was a terrible event and it was a waste of time going.
The interesting thing that I've heard from a number of athletes, how the best thing they say about the Olympic Games is the Olympic Village. They said, because it is the only time as an athlete, and these are some athletes that participate in sports that aren't just Olympic sports, and they were saying it's the only time that the media are not allowed in. And they said it is absolutely brilliant, because you can totally relax. And you can sit with other athletes and share experiences, share ideas. And they said it's the only time you ever get that without any intrusion from the likes of us outsiders going, oh, so what's it like? You know.
I think we saw that starting to change, though, at the last Olympics. And it will change even more at the next Olympics with the advent of social media being what it is. And, I mean, Twitter and those sorts of things were very much a new phenomenon the last Olympics around. This time, they are well cemented within society. It'll be interesting to see people's attitudes to, you know, what goes on in the village being displayed through social media.
I think that's going to be very interesting, because knowing, as I say, the athletes who've made those comments about how wonderful it is that they are finally cocooned as one group of elite athletes, the people that break that silence or tweet or put a photograph or something out into the world, I think you're going to see them, the reaction towards them will be pretty strong, I believe, from all the other athletes.
Well, imagine dedicating 4, 6, 8 years of your life, working your guts out to this one particular meet. You make it there, which is an achievement on its own. You compete, and that night you're letting your hair down, you have a couple, and you might end up, say, a little bit face down. And some dog goes and posts a picture of you on the internet and says, oh, look at this person, aren't they funny? And that becomes the image of you as an athlete, not the 4 or 6, 8 years of hard work and dedication you put in.
It'd be interesting to know if the IOC put anything in the terms and conditions of staying in the Olympic Village, whether, you know, such a picture as you're talking about would be an invasion of privacy, and that you've all signed a contract to say you will not do this, and if you do, you're liable under this ruling. It would be very interesting to know.
And I just hope at the next Olympics we don't have people looking for signs of athletes with body fat. Just stay away from that this time around.
Well, as we've been talking about in recent weeks, the FFA continued their battle with the Matildas, the Socceroos and the A-League players. It doesn't seem to be going very far very quickly. The one thing that astounds me, John, is I think the Matildas were very foolish not to go to America, and I think they've probably harmed their reputation, and most of all they've probably harmed the chance of getting a sponsor on board, because when you pull out of something like that against the world number one, the world champions, sponsors do not want to be associated to teams who take that sort of action where their brand by association can be damaged. So I think that was really foolish. The one thing I don't understand, John, is, you know, the FFA hanging on to the money that the girls won as prize money for making it through to the quarterfinals. Now, the story I hear is because the CBA had run out, that is why they're holding on to that money. But to me, the girls have earned it, hanged it over, and at least let them have some reward financially for all their efforts, when we know how little money they've received to have got to that stage anyway. And I think the FFA looks really bad by hanging on to that money.
Yeah, I think you're right in that particular case, in that particular point in this whole argument, and there's a lot of little points being thrown around everywhere by everybody. I mean, we've spoken before on this program, if the men were really interested in parity for the girls, they know what they can do. And that's straight up. That's without any issues at all. They could just say, here you go, ladies, you're worth a bit more than that. We can afford to take a bit less. I don't reckon Tim Cahill's going to notice another $5,000 missing from a match payment.
Well,
maybe.
I must mention, because I did say, I think it was on the last show, that they were earning $20,000 a game. Now, I do know that was the case leading up to the World Cup, and I think I prefaced that on the show if you listen back to it, but we do know now that they are being paid around $7,500 a game per player.
Which is still of a hell of a lot more than $500.
It's still in the top 10 in the world. Yeah, of international players in the world.
Okay.
Australia, one of the highest paid international teams by comparison, and yet they're ranked in the 50s.
One thing I am interested in is if this isn't all sorted by the time of the next World Cup qualifier, or the next time Australia plays, are the men going to do the righty by the women and strike for their game? Because let's face it, that's what the women did this time around. That's as much for the men as it is for them.
Well, that would be very interesting, and I'll tell you now, they won't do that.
No, but, didn't think so.
You know, it would be... Yeah, I think you raise a very, very good point there, John.
These girls were led down the path by the Players Association to take this on. Have no doubt about it. And why are they taking it on? So the men can make more money. The girls are going to get something out of it as well. But you didn't see the boys calling a strike so the girls could get more money.
Yeah, I think they were very foolish. Whoever advised them to go in under the umbrella of the men and the A-League was foolish, but anyway.
And good on Lisa Devana.
Absolutely.
I mean, she's a co-captain, and regardless of whether you think the girls should have gone on strike or not, the role of a captain is actually to say, no, I'm not going on strike. Captains don't go on strike. That's my view.
Well, I spoke to Lisa a few weeks ago, and I mean, she was saying the thing that she did not want to happen was this, to detract from their Olympic qualification. Yeah. They haven't qualified for the last two Olympic Games, and she wants to go to an Olympics. And the last time the preparation was terrible, in that after the World Cup, all the girls went off on holiday to Croatia and Greece and whatever, came back overweight, unfit, and they didn't get good enough preparation, a one-week camp before they went off to play, and they didn't get the results they needed. This time, Alan Stajic had the planning there to do the right preparation. They've just missed out on two crucial games against the USA, which would have been, you know, ideal preparation.
And the next time the Matildas' name comes up amongst American sports promoters, do you reckon any of them are going to touch it?
Certainly not TV companies or even spectators.
No. They've done a whole lot of damage to their brand that they'll take them a long time to resurrect.
Now, we bagged the FFA. Just quickly, okay. John, they've announced this week that there will be now three full-time professional referees, which I applaud. I've been calling for it for a long time. Congratulations to the three chosen men, Chris Beath, Jared Gillett and Ben Williams. Ben Williams, I think, is probably one of the better referees in the A-League. Now, they've been contracted now to the Hyundai A-League for the next two seasons. And David Gallop said, the reality is that limited resources for Australian football means we've not been able to take this initiative until season 11. And I do wish they'd stop saying season 11, season 12, until this season anyway. We'll start with a panel of three instead of a full panel of seven, which would be required to cover every single Hyundai A-League match. It's a compromise, but it's a move in the right direction. Our long-term vision is to increase the number of full-time professional referees in the Hyundai A-League and eventually the Westfield W League in due course. Well, it would be nice if they'd have maybe had a couple in the W League that for a bit of parity.
I understand where the position the A-League finds itself in. They don't have any money. They can't just afford to do these sorts of things. I can see what the next whinge out of the A-League is going to be. How come Melbourne and Sydney keep getting the full-time referees and we get the part-timers at our game?
Exactly. But the other thing that raises with this is, again, as you said there's not the money. They'll want full-time. They want seven full-time referees. But then the players are asking for more money, which means that the FFA can't have more full-time referees. So this is where the players have to get some perspective. If you want this, you can't have that. It's choose which is more important.
I think if the players had someone sit them down and say very quietly, now look, if you want to make that sort of money, become good enough to play in a league that supports that pay scale. That's simple. There's plenty of leagues around the world that pay more than the A-League. All you have to do is be good enough to play in it. Now, staying with football, we had the Soccer Pools Cup over the last weekend, and Sorrento getting up over the top of Perth SC 2-1. Jamie Harnwell's first season as coach. Pulls off a premiership and his brother scores a winning goal as well. Scores the second goal.
Well, it's not
goal.
The premiership. This was the cup final. But yeah, no. Todd Harnwell scoring the second goal
in his final game for the Sorrento.
Not a bad way to sign off.
And I think he's played over 400 games.
He's played a lot of games. He's been around a long time, and of course had a short stint with the Glory himself. Mm. And there's no doubting Sorrento thoroughly deserved their victory. And Steve McDonald got the Stan Lazaridis medal. You know, football's a game of opinions, and I don't want to take anything away from his performance because he did set up the first goal with a brilliant header back across the penalty area. But I thought Scott Bullock was outstanding for Sorrento, and just really wanted to say that, and he would have probably got my nod. Just one thing I will say, John, as well, which I think was a little bit disappointing about the final, was there were a lot of people my age, probably I would say, the bulk of the crowd was 40 plus, and you just wonder where are the fans of the future going to be, because it's all guys that played 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago that are still there going to watch these games. But it was quite sad how few sort of 20 and 30 year olds there were watching that cup final.
Well, that's across all sports. I don't think you'll find football, soccer, football is any different than any other sport. And organised team sport is starting to hurt. There's a lot more activities people can do, and they don't have to just do it on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon or whenever games are fixtured. They can go to the gym anytime. You can put your rollerblades on anytime, whatever they happen to be. It's sad. But they should have been able to watch the game at home, shouldn't they?
What do you mean?
Well, wasn't the game, I'm led to believe the game was telecast.
Oh, look, there were cameras there from the Central College of TAFE. Someone's told me there were seven cameras. Certainly there was an OB. There was an OB truck that was sort of obviously managing all of the cameras. But it wasn't live stream, which was a bit strange. I had people coming up to me asking, you know, because we'd streamed the game the week before the Western Knights, why was this game not being streamed? I don't have the answers. As I said to them, you need to call Football West. Just one thing actually on that I wanted to mention. Peter Huggin is notes in the program, which was really disappointing. That was the only thing apart from the teams listed.
At least you got a program at the Soccer Pools Cup. Couldn't get one for a World Cup qualifier.
But he says in his notes there about, with state government support, the combined efforts of Football Federation Australia and Football West and the enormous backing of the public, WA reasserted itself as a genuine destination for our national team. Well, I don't know how it reasserted itself, because I didn't know we'd actually put any mark down to say we need to have it. I would have thought that was the mark thrown down this time. But anyway, it also lent weight to the game's argument that it deserves a home of football to service all aspects of our growing sport. I don't think it did anything for that, to be honest. And I'm still against the home of football. I just don't see. But then the one thing I would say is the announcement that Belmont Park is going to go. Why don't Football West say to the government, can we have a part of that to put our pitches in our new Fandango facility? Because there's open space there, and it would be a brand new facility for football with new pitches and use of space that's coming up for grabs.
It would make sense. It's nice and central too.
Absolutely. Train stations are nearby, the freeway's nearby. At the moment, there's parking. So it actually ticks all of the boxes.
I'm interested to know whether their plans include having a venue, and or are they always going to continue to play the big games at a stadium like NIB or the new stadium?
My understanding is that, having read the plans and attended some of the meetings previously, is that they want to have an AstroTurf pitch that will be under floodlights that visiting teams can use as a training facility. And there will be club rooms, changing rooms, etc. There was talk at one stage that there would be sort of like dormitory-style accommodation so that they could actually stay at the facility as well. I'm not sure if that's still in place, but that was certainly discussed at one point. The one thing that I do know in the original plans was there was Football West wanted the what is now the NPL to play games there on a Friday night and possibly on another night of the weekend. But, of course, the clubs are going, well, hang on a sec, that will rob us of bar takings, it will canteen takings, all of that. And so, you know, I don't think that's a particularly good idea. The clubs are doing it hard enough at the moment. The last thing you want to do is take away any possibility of them earning any money.
I'm surprised they want to put down an AstroTurf pitch.
Well, it's, look, you know, Mr. Hug feels that that's a better way of doing it in the climate here. It's easier for the grass
to look after. Did Mr. Hug not read the press reports from the Matildas following their games in Canada that were played on AstroTurf? Canada, of course, being, well, that well-known hot desert type country. This is Perth. He should go and ask a few hockey players what it's like to run around on an AstroTurf when it's 35 degrees in Perth. I just think in a city like this where we grow grass out of our ears because we can't help it, that would make perfect sense.
And don't forget, we export our grass as well.
Yeah, we do.
Dubai buys a lot of it.
It's just staggering that we would think that AstroTurf is the way to go.
I think there's a lot...
Would you like to play on AstroTurf?
I think soccer? From my day when I did play on it, it's come a hell of a long way. I mean, in fact, the ones in Canberra, when I saw them, I was so impressed. I think people thought I was a bit of a loony because I started throwing myself around on the pitch. There was no one around, just to see what it was like to land on it as a goalkeeper. And it is come light years in the last 20 years.
But
the big thing that everybody forgets, and when I did the documentary through Africa, where, if you remember, FIFA promised it was going to put 13 pitches. I think they've only put 5 so far, and we're, what, now 5 years after the World Cup was held there?
20 years.
Yeah, but anyway. The biggest thing is the maintenance. If you do not do the maintenance, they do not last, and it's crucial. And Sutherland Shire in Sydney, when the Glory Youth played there, when we were commentating that on the station, I remember talking to them, and they were saying that they were told the pitch would last 7 years. They used it every single day of the year, except for Christmas Day. And he goes, we do the maintenance religiously every day. And he goes, we're not going to get 7 years.
No way.
They got about, I think, 5. Now the manufacturers are saying you'll get 10 years out of it, which I think if you pull it back, if you're going to use it that much, you'll probably get 7. So, you know, it's a big investment, but the maintenance is the key. You have to do it.
From a playing perspective, it's great until it dries out. And you can't turn the sprinklers on halfway through a game. and the pitches are angled. They're not flat. They have a rise in the middle and fall off to the sides for the drainage, and you get a strip down the middle of the ground that is dry. And if you go over on that, you will burn yourself. And it's not nice.
I'm not in favour of it, put it that way. I think fine as a training pitch for development, to develop skills, no problems whatsoever. But for serious competition, nah.
No.
Well, I think we've probably gone on again way too long.
We've covered it all.
We have covered it all. We hope you've enjoyed it. And we'll be back very soon with another podcast for Not the Footy Show.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.